Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 18th, 2011. So maybe this has happened to you. You're driving along, minding your own business, and wham, you're rear-ended. And with more cities desperate for cash, you're then whammed by something else, a bill. We will hear about the so-called crash tax. Here's one way to make a marriage accident-free. Apply some basic rules of economics. There's cost-benefit analysis, incentives, and of course, good old supply and demand.
And what they found is they didn't have amazing sex. They had sort of mediocre sex, but they had a lot of it. And they would be the first people to tell you that a lot of mediocre sex is better than no amazing sex.
We're going there. And thanks to a new online game, anyone can experience a small dose of what it's like to be homeless.
The game does a very good job of showing what the reality is. And if you're faced with that reality even over 2 months' time, it becomes very stressful.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
This week, regulators from the SEC, the Federal Reserve, and beyond went to Capitol Hill to warn of underfunded budgets, especially in light of what they're supposed to be doing under the Financial Reform Act. House Republicans put an item into their budget proposal to cut funding for the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau almost in half. But amid the budget noise, the Bureau set up a new website and a new Twitter account asking for your thoughts on credit cards and mortgages and the like. So we thought we'd ask Elizabeth Warren for her thoughts. She's helping to get the Bureau up and running. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You gave a speech this week at the 75th anniversary of Consumers Union and accused critics of this new bureau of trying to chip away at its independence. And this, of course, is a reference to efforts on Capitol Hill to withhold funding for the agency. You warned this fight is not over. So what steps are you taking?
Partly the steps we're taking is we're getting out there and doing our business. We're setting up this agency like we're supposed to. We're starting to produce pieces of what's going to be new things coming out of the consumer agency, you know, shortened credit agreements, trying to get rid of fine print. We're trying to set the teams in place who will be able to enforce the law. You know, we're doing our job.
How much of that are you actually able to do now, or do you have to wait until July?
As you rightly indicate, our legal powers come into effect on July 21st of this year. So this is our put it together phase. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in the put it together phase, including starting to talk about where we think change is important. We're telling the industry what it is that we want to see, and we're already starting to pull them in, have good conversations with them, but to work on prototypes. So when July 21st comes, we'll be ready to go.
Well, the Bureau does have this new website, and you've been asking consumers to write in with their suggestions. What are you hearing about so far? What are the major concerns?
This is a beta version of the website. You know, my team keeps reminding me it's not as perfect as it could be, and I keep saying it's 6 months early. This is good. And so what we've done is we've launched a feature called Open for Suggestions, and we invite people to send us suggestions, comments. Can send them by Twitter, they can send them by email, they can send them by doing a YouTube video. So a lot of people have, for example, talked to us about the importance of financial education and how they're hoping we're going to make this a big priority at the agency. So we have responded and talked about what we hope to do, what our ideas are, but we're already getting ideas from other people.
I saw a tweet from your agency recently inviting leaders of the religious community to work with you. What role do you see for them in your consumer protection efforts?
Well, you know, a lot of religious leaders are really on the front lines out there. They're dealing with people in their congregations across the country, people who've either been slammed recently in the economy or the constant strain of not enough dollars to make it to the end of the month. I see the religious community as potentially a really important partner with this new agency, and they help us think about how to design the right kinds of solutions, understanding the problem and moving toward making some meaningful changes.
One of your most widely known quotes is about how we have or had more rules protecting people from exploding toasters than from things like exploding mortgages. How far do you think we've come at this point toward changing that, and how?
We haven't yet changed it.
Hmm.
I mean, we're going to. Hey, look, the good news is we've got a consumer agency and we're building it. You know, I wish we were a 60-minute television show, you know, so here after the third commercial, the agency would already be up and running and, you know, have all its pieces in place and you know, the cute people who work here would already be ready for their star turns. But the good news is we have opened the door.
Elizabeth Warren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that website, by the way, is consumerfinance.gov. You know, a topic is controversial when people can't even agree on what to call it. That is most definitely the case with the subject of our next story, a growing trend around the country called, well,
we call them crash taxes.
The crash tax.
It's not a tax.
It really isn't a crash tax.
All right. Now that we got that cleared up, Chrissy Clark of KQED in San Francisco explains what these things are and why there's such a fuss about them and how they might be coming to a car crash near you.
Let's put the terminology aside for a moment and consider a balmy Monday last May in the Southern California town of Cathedral City. A high school football star named Michael Carles is in his truck driving back from the gym when the car in front of him brakes suddenly to avoid a bus stopped at a bus stop. Carles tries to brake too, but it's too late.
My car was smashed, leaking engine coolant and oil.
Carles is in Ohio now, in college, but when I caught him on the phone recently, he remembered the scene well. A fire engine came to make sure everybody was okay. They were. The firefighters cleaned up the oily mess on the road and left. A few weeks later, he got something in the mail.
A bill from the fire department for $400.
$469.49, to be exact, according to Rhonda Guillaume, the admin assistant for the Cathedral City Fire Department. She should know. She sent it.
What we have here is an invoice for a hazardous material cleanup.
Cathedral City charges the at-fault driver for spills like this. Guillaume goes down the list of costs in Michael Carles' spill, item by item. $17.50 for 20 minutes of a firefighter's time, $138 for the oil cleanup kit.
Which includes the hazardous materials absorbent.
All in all, the stuff we take for granted when the fire department swoops in. But swooping in costs money, which has to come from somewhere. And increasingly, as fire departments across the country face shrinking budgets and growing expectations of service, that money's coming from the people actually involved in the accident. Cities in nearly 30 states now charge fees that critics call crash taxes. Others call them
cost recovery.
Bill Soakey is the chief of the Cathedral City Fire Department.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, and so I think most people understand that there's a cost with providing those services.
As if on cue, a report of an accident interrupts us over the radio dispatch.
Yeah, those services. And so they're willing to pay a few dollars.
Or more typically, a few $100. The charges go for different things, depending on which fire department you're talking about. Some charge for directing traffic, some for helicopter evacuations. Regardless, California State Senator Tony Strickland thinks the basic idea of cities charging for the cost of accident response is just wrong.
The most essential role of government, especially at the local level, is public safety. And if they're not funding that as a priority, what are they funding?
Strickland, a Republican, recently introduced a bill modeled after laws in 10 other states that would make it illegal for California cities to charge for accident response.
They need to start strapping their belt just like every hardworking Californian family is doing right now.
I put that to Fire Chief Bill Soakey in Cathedral City.
We're at the point where there's not much more belt tightening to do.
To illustrate his point, he opens the giant door to the fire station, where one of the city's fire trucks has been mothballed because of budget cuts.
This is our ladder truck. It's browned out currently. On the other side is an ambulance that normally we staff up.
Soakey says in tough financial times like this, recovering the costs for accident response can be the best bad option.
Some communities may decide, no, we're going to shut down a library or we're going to close a park. Those are the kinds of tough choices that communities are facing.
Cities typically recover a few $100,000 a year out of accident recovery programs. Of course, if you happen to be driving through a community that has implemented one of these programs and you do get in an accident, the next question is, will your car insurance cover the extra costs? That's what I wondered, so I called my broker's office.
Hey, from how can I help you?
This is Chrissy Clark. I have a theoretical question, sir.
Oh, sure. The old friend of a friend of a friend. I know.
She looked at my liability policy.
So
it kind of leaves it open. We'd have to look at the circumstances.
So I followed up with Sam Sorich. He's president of the Association of California Insurance Companies.
There is no express inclusion in the typical policy for a fire department's response to an accident.
But when I press him, Sorich says there's typically no express exclusion either. Then he warns, if insurance policies start paying out on these things more often, premiums might go up. As for Michael Carls, the football player who crashed his truck, he says his insurance refused to cover the bill he got from the fire department.
I mean, maybe the city, they should have like a fund for that or something to that effect.
When I point out they could by raising taxes, he reconsiders.
I'd rather just pay it once than like having to like pay a tax for it for other people, you know?
Which, when you get right down to it, is the crux of the difference between taxes and fees, after all, and where people's own pocketbooks meet a tricky political debate. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace Money.
The two bulwarks of the U.S. housing market, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are under a serious microscope. There's increasing talk of getting rid of them, or at least scaling them back significantly. For potential homeowners, that means without Fannie and Freddie, or something similar, banks will not have a lot of incentive to keep offering 30-year mortgages. Commentator Bethany McLean says that would be bad news for the middle class.
The 30-year mortgage has helped generations of Americans afford homes. The long repayment period allows for affordable payments, and the fixed rate means that households aren't subject to the shock of increasing interest rates. And that's partly why more than 60% of Americans own their homes. But more than that, we've been taught that owning a home is a right in our current system, and the 30-year mortgage is part of that. But for lenders and investors, a 30-year mortgage is not such a great thing. In fact, it's a financial Frankenstein. It's an unnatural product that is filled with the potential for losses. A lender can be trapped by the interest rate or by the risk that we don't pay our mortgages. That's a big part of why the government created Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to buy up those mortgages, to make that 30-year mortgage available. So where are we now? In the wake of the crisis, lenders and investors are understandably more terrified of credit risk than ever before. If the government won't take the credit risk on long-term mortgages for average Americans, it's not clear anyone will. One much-discussed solution is to create new companies that would do pretty much what the old Fannie and Freddie did, provide a government guarantee of the credit on such mortgages. A better solution might be for financial institutions to offer only the mortgage products that they wanted to keep on their own books. This would indeed get the government out of the mortgage business. But the important point is that there's a trade-off involved. Any 30-year product would almost certainly be offered on a more limited basis and at a higher price than it is today. And it would make buying a home more expensive. But that's a conversation worth having. Is homeownership a government priority? Or should Americans who want to buy homes be forced to save more? Because the promise of a perfect world where average Americans can get low-cost mortgages and the government is nowhere to be seen is a mirage.
Bethany McLean writes for Vanity Fair.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Ever wonder how much you could get from careful, perhaps lucky, investing? 5%? 10%? Well, how about 7,000%? Now, before you get whipped into a frenzy, what we're talking about is not a stock or a new market strategy. It was an online stock market game in Germany. It let contestants use real market prices to trade. And though the portfolios used fake, Monopoly-style money, the winner got a very real prize. Our Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio was in Germany when he heard about the contest, and he managed to track down the champion.
First things first, help from a German colleague on how to congratulate the contest winner when I meet him.
Wunsch.
Very good. Excellent.
What's the rest of it?
Zum Gewinn des Porsche.
Catch that. Porsche. As in a $144,000 German sports car, the grand prize Carrera S. I'd heard about the contest.
a tool to bring a lot of new people into the stock investment world.
From Reiner Ries, a honcho at the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, during a chat about persuading reluctant Germans to buy and sell stocks after so many got burnt during the dot-com and IPO mania 10 years ago.
A virtual portfolio to try to really resemble how stock exchange trading works.
Fake Money, Real Prices, 3 months, sponsored by the German Exchange and the newspaper Handelsblatt. 19,000 entries, and the top prize went to one Klaus Neukert of Munich. Sure, he said, meet him at the cafe in the lobby at work. Time to try out my canned congratulations.
Herzlichen Glückwunsch zum Gewinn des Porsche.
Vielen Dank. Thank you very much.
Turns out Klaus, fresh-faced, 30 years old in a puffy down jacket, speaks English just fine. He started the contest with 20,000 virtual euros. Like real life, there were transaction costs, a hefty 50 fake euros a trade. 3 months later, Klaus's virtual portfolio had 1.4 million euros in it, $1.8 million.
Yes, it's unbelievable.
He started off buying and selling quickly.
Yeah, it was kind of a day trading.
Then he turned to derivatives based on the key German stock index, the DAX.
You can bet on it if it will fall or will increase.
How is it that you were able to figure out derivatives?
It was quite easy for me.
Did I mention Klaus is a finance expert at a fancy bank that from the outside looks like a pair of 20-story tall rockets of capitalism ready to launch? But perhaps his biggest blessing, the contest had an end date. With more time, Klaus figures the law of averages would have caught up with him.
It's, to be honest, it's also a lot of luck.
Der neue 911.
Die neue 911, the new 911 prize Porsche, presents a different kind of financial challenge. Insurance costs a fortune, about $9,000 a year. Cash he could use for the house he's building with his wife in case they have kids. Also, he's been told the car will lose 10% of its value the moment he first drives away. But it won't lose more for a few months if he keeps it free of dents. He's thinking he might hold on to the car during this plateau of residual value. But it's not like he needs a car. Klaus already owns a scooter and one other vehicle, a pokey, snub-nosed smart car. So to keep or not to keep the Porsche is going to be quite a choice when he takes delivery up in Frankfurt.
At least I have to drive back to Munich. I think on the Autobahn that will be fun.
In that car, on that road, he can do the 250-mile ride home in under 3 hours. Time enough to ponder whether he wants to make the smart car choice or the fast car choice. In Munich, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace Money.
You can find more from David, plus a peek at a virtual stock exchange game for kids on the Economy 4.0 blog at marketplace.org. Got issues in your marriage? Yeah, who doesn't, right? Well, you could get counseling. You could, I don't know, watch Dr. Phil. Or you could read the book written by our next guests. It's called Spousonomics. And in it, Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson say if you only treated your marriage like the business partnership that it is, many of those issues just might solve themselves. It is behavioral finance for the bedroom and beyond, and it is both helpful and hilarious. Paula and Jenny, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here. So what made either of you think that the dismal science had anything to say about romance?
Well, isn't it obvious? Well, actually, it's called the dismal science, but technically economics is a study of the allocation of scarce resources, which we kind of find has incredibly apt parallels to marriage, because what are we doing if not trying to allocate time, money, patience, energy, libido?
Right. I was going to pipe in with that one.
Yeah. And, you know, it used to be easy to allocate it all when it was just one person, and then suddenly it's two people, and then maybe there's kids, and it's even more people, and it's a real challenge. So economics seems actually apt.
Right. Well, all kinds of terms pop up in the book. Moral hazard, division of labor, supply and demand, bubbles, all these economic terms. And it all really boils down to your contention that marriage is a market of goods and services. How on earth are we supposed to think of ourselves that way? Jenny?
one of our objectives in writing this book was to try to give people sort of a toolkit of other ideas of approaching problems in other ways. So, you know, the too big to fail marriage, we think about that in the context of Citigroup or Lehman Brothers, right? They were too big to fail. They took reckless risks because there were no consequences to their actions. Well, when we get married, are we taking reckless risks because we think, well, we're married now. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to exercise. We don't have to be nice to each other. We don't have to have sex all the time. But right. It's not too big to fail.
We don't have to close the door when we go to the bathroom.
Right. I mean, it is too big to fail. We know the numbers. So we're trying to give a different construct to people to look at their issues.
Well, yeah, you know, and you mentioned exchanging chores, and this is where you talk about the division of labor. And you have examples in the book of couples who basically keep bar graphs in their heads of who's doing what around the house and, you know, whether things are fair. I can't relate to that at all.
Right. Neither can we.
Neither can we.
Right, exactly.
I think everyone does some scorekeeping. That's the problem.
No, never, never. But you use this example of doing the dishes to illustrate an economic concept called comparative advantage, specialization. Tell us about the dishes.
The issue really is, what are you better at vis-a-vis the other chores? So it's just trying to divide up everything. So if I'm a little bit faster at doing the dishes, but a lot faster at doing the laundry, then I should definitely do the laundry and you should do the dishes. And you can change it up. And it's, you know, this isn't a recipe for you have to do the dishes for the rest of your life.
Right.
But when you sort of look at the tasks that need to be done, you need to sort of be a little bit more tactical about who does what and think a little bit more about who's better at what.
We don't get married anymore for the economic reasons that people used to get married. So why do we get married? We get married because we like each other. We get married because it's fun. So if you can take care of the business side of it more efficiently, which economists can help with, then you can have more fun time left over.
And with those free hours, let's get back to the business of being romantic and being in love and having fun, because thank God the damn dishes are done.
Well, let's talk about that extra leisure time, because you spend an entire chapter talking about supply and demand, or how to have more sex. And I guess it's pretty easy to figure out where the supply and demand come from here, but you start the chapter with a bar graph.
Right. Well,
the negative sloping demand curve. You never thought about your sex life in those terms?
We just thought that would really grab people who wanted to know about sex as a nice bar graph.
Right. So tell us about the cost-benefit analysis here. You say that the key to more sex is lowering the cost of it, but we are not talking about what it sounds like we're talking about.
Right. We're not saying pay less. I mean, if you pay your spouse for sex, then that's your business and that's fine.
Right.
But and you need more than our book to help you, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or maybe you have got it all figured out. I don't know.
The basis of the supply and demand is that lower costs and demand goes up, right?
Yeah.
When things are cheaper, you want more of them. So the argument is, make it cheaper for yourself and make it easier for yourself. We talked to so many couples who said, you know, by the time I get home, we put the kids to bed, we make dinner, you know, we're on our Blackberries, have to go back, maybe answer a few more emails. You know, we get in bed, it's like, ugh, just want to watch Jon Stewart and go to bed. A lot of couples had found some really creative solutions for making it easier for themselves. And one couple set a goal. They said, you know, we're going to have sex 3 times a week for the next whatever
Operation
it was.
Operation Hat Trick.
Yeah, Operation Hat Trick, which is, you know, 3 goals in ice hockey. And they did it. And what they found is they didn't have amazing sex. They had sort of mediocre sex, but they had a lot of it. And they would be the first people to tell you that a lot of mediocre sex is better than no amazing sex. And that seemed to be the goal. We're all waiting for sort of a big chunk of time so we can have amazing sex. And then expectations are high and you sort of have to think about it. And then people are more intimidated by it. Whereas if it's just, you know what, let's just cut out some time maybe before dinner when we're not so tired or before we have to return to our computers to do the last hour of work every night. Make it easier for yourself, and maybe you'll have a little bit more sex.
Well, you are both relative newlyweds, so let me ask each of you, is there any problem or conflict in your marriage that economics has not been able to remedy? Jenny?
I think my husband would answer my tone of voice.
Mm.
I don't know that economics has been as effective as we would like it to be. I wrote a chapter on incentives, and
right.
Clearly nagging and punishment and sort of making someone feel terrible is not a particularly productive incentive to get what you want. And the economic research does actually hold this up. And yet I find myself at times not taking that to heart. I hope I'm a little bit better at it, but I'm sure he would concur that my tone of voice is not as spousonomical as he would like it to be.
Paula?
I would say this idea that we talk about in the book of not flooding your partner with information, I've tried and I'm better at it, but not completely great at, when I get upset about something, not listing, you know, a bunch of other things that happen to be upsetting me at the same time or a bunch of other things he's done. As you can tell, I've kind of lost my voice. And he was like, oh, my God, this is like the fantasy life for me. You can't even speak. And I was like, enjoy it while it lasts, my friend, because in a couple days, I'm going to be back in action.
She's saving up.
Guys, it's been awfully fun. Loved the book. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson, I call them the Keynesian Kinseys, are co-authors of the new book, Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. When they are not busy writing a bestseller, Paula is a page one editor at the Wall Street Journal, and Jenny is a longtime financial reporter for the New York Times. And here is an offer you cannot refuse. They have agreed to do some Spousonomics counseling with one lucky couple. If you've got a sense of humor and are willing to air some of your marital and financial dirty laundry, go to marketplace.org/money, click on contact, and tell us why you need a dose of Spousonomics.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Alan Escobar, and we're at Colorado Boulevard, Pasadena. I have my school ID, university cards, and some guitar picks. I have guitar picks because I'm a musician, and say there's a guitar somewhere out there, someone's playing, I can just ask and see if I can go play. It doesn't happen that often, but it happens. Last time it happened to me, I was in downtown, and some guy was playing blues on the street, and I just asked, hey, can I play? He's like, can you play the blues? I was like, yeah. So I started playing the blues, and it was just wowed. I have 6 guitar picks in here. I guess I started carrying them once I got to high school, once I started taking the bus around. I used to carry my guitar around, so whenever I'd need money or something, I'd run low, I'd always play at the bus stop, get some cash.
I told you you had to make it through this month with only $1,000 for everything, food, shelter, clothing. That is just slightly over the federal poverty level for a single person. Could you make it? Well, you are asked to imagine that reality in a new online game called Spent. It's a joint effort by the ad agency McKinney and Urban Ministries of Durham, North Carolina. You can check it out while you listen to this at playspent.org. And for a tour of sorts, I'm joined by Patrice Nelson, the Executive Director of Urban Ministries. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's go through the game a little bit. You know, the first thing that you see is that over 14 million Americans are homeless. Now imagine you're one of them. Your savings are gone. You've lost your house and you're down to your last $1,000. And it asks, can you make it through the month? So you can either exit at that point, or your other option is to find a job. So I'm going to click on that now. The first thing I see is that I'm running out of money fast. And then it asks me to click on a job. And the options there for me are
restaurant worker, a temp, or a warehouse worker.
Okay, so let's see, what should we choose? How about a warehouse worker?
I usually choose warehouse worker, too. That's the highest salary of all of them.
So it is.
So you have the best shot. But for the warehouse worker, I think you may also have to buy a uniform.
You do indeed. And that's going to cost me $275, reducing my weekly paycheck by about $70. And what you do throughout this is once somebody makes a choice, you reveal to them not only what that means for their paycheck, but also some of the ramifications of those choices.
Yes, it becomes obvious that some of the choices that we make are very complicated and there are no easy answers.
Can you give us a wrap-up of the major choices that we have to make throughout the month here?
The first choice you have to make is where you're going to live, whether you want to live far away where the rent is going to be cheaper, but then your gas prices are going to be higher, or you can live close in and just the opposite will be true. Your rent will be higher. And then once you decide where you're going to live, you have to pay your rent, and then you have an option, once you've started your job, of deciding whether you want to opt in or out of health insurance.
You mentioned choosing how far away from your workplace you are going to live, and this is a sliding scale. So I'm going to choose to live, let's say, 40 miles away. That means, of course, that I'm paying more in gas. but my rent's going to be lower. So now my total cost is going to be $782 a month. You use this as a point in time to talk about the lack of affordable housing.
And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about the game and the way McKinney has worked with us to include statistics and important facts on homelessness and on affordability in our community.
There also seems to be an instruction in here for people who might be going through this. In the game, I got a call from a collection agency.
Hi, I'm calling from Consumer Collections Corp. Hello?
And my choice was either to return that call or hang up.
Hello?
And that is the point of the game that is very interesting to me. I've answered the call and then I've also hung up, but that bill is still there.
Right. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these days, but I made it to the end of the month with $14. But I made a lot of sacrifices, most of them at the expense of my children. For example, I didn't let them buy ice cream from the ice cream truck. And, you know, I made them get the reduced lunch program at school instead of giving them money.
I always choose that the kid would get lunch program as well. But there is a stigma attached, unfortunately, and there is something to pushing that button that helps the person who's playing the game to actually share in being able to feel what that's like.
Yeah, and in a really strange way. I mean, obviously, there's no way to compare playing this game to actually going through this, but I did. I felt terrible that I couldn't let my kid have, you know, a little thing of ice cream from the ice cream truck.
But that's reality.
Yeah.
The game does a very good job of showing what the reality is. And if you're faced with that reality even over 2 months' time, it becomes very stressful and you do feel spent.
That was Patrice Nelson with the Urban Ministries of Durham. It's a nonprofit organization supporting that city's homeless population. We have a link to the game Spent at marketplace.org/money. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vigeland, and it's the time in the show when we take your money questions. With me this week is the most read personal finance columnist on the internet, our good friend Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
We heard earlier in the show about the possible demise of the 30-year mortgage if, you know, the folks on Capitol Hill follow through on their threats to get rid of Fannie and Freddie, or at least drastically downscale them. How big a difference would that make for the average homeowner or potential homeowner?
It's a pretty big difference. I mean, what the banks would want to switch to if they didn't have that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guarantee is a variable rate mortgage.
Uh-huh.
So we would be subject to whatever's going on in the interest rate world. And everybody's talking about inflation right now, which means, you know, rates that could go up. So it would be a drastic change. And it would be, I think, a lot harder for people to budget and know what they were going to be able to afford for a house.
Right. And that's what got a lot of people in trouble over the last few years is an adjustable rate mortgage, right?
Well, I do think that banks would be a little bit smarter about, I hope the banks would be a little bit smarter about their underwriting criteria. But yeah, there could be a situation where we'd see, you know, real inflation and big jumps in interest rates and you'd see big jumps in your payments.
All right. Well, enough of Fannie and Freddie. Let's hit the phones. And Nate is with us from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Tess. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, it's our pleasure, especially to take one from a fellow Oregonian.
Lifelong.
Yeah. Is it raining?
It is raining. It's been beautiful weather for the last month. As the rest of the nation is frozen, we've been dry and sunny and beautiful.
Wow. That's a change for Oregonians.
The clouds have rolled in, though, and it's been raining for the past day and a half or so.
So what do you do there in Eugene, aside from go to Grateful Dead concerts?
Well, I have spent the last 4 years of my life in the taxi industry.
Oh.
First as a dispatcher, and then I bought a taxi back in April 2010. I've recently sold that taxi and gotten out of the industry. I've come to the conclusion that I'm not cut out for that business, and I'm actually preparing for a move back to your old stomping grounds in Portland.
Oh, my goodness. What are you going to do there?
I'm applying to Portland State University to finish my bachelor's degree,
good
majoring in sociology.
Good for you.
Until then, I guess I'm just going to get whatever type of work I can. I got to say, I miss getting paid for my time.
Yes. So would this be a question about student loans then?
No, it's not, actually. This is a question about my credit card.
Well, you are talking to the right person.
Wonderful.
Liz literally wrote the book and multiple books on credit.
Wonderful. I'm in real credit trouble right now.
Okay.
A few years ago, I had a credit card, and I was constantly getting these offers in the mail saying, you know, 0% interest for the first 12 months, you're pre-approved. I got so tired of them that I sent in a formal request to no longer receive those offers.
Uh-huh.
Since then, I got married, and a lot of that cost went onto that credit card. And the problem now is the finance charge just seems to eat that right up.
So you're missing those pre-approved envelopes at this point.
I really am. I would love to get an envelope in the mail that says you're pre-approved. And meantime, my wife is still getting these offers in the mail. I'm getting a little jealous.
Marital discord over credit card offers. Okay,
right.
Got it. There are a few things you can do. You can go back to the opt-out site and say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong. Please take me back."
Please.
Yes, but you know, you may not see that flood of offers you're expecting because you know the direct marketers are sending out a lot fewer. And they tend to be focusing them on people with really good credit scores.
Nate, do you know what your credit score is?
I do, and I actually have very good credit. I have a credit score of 750 right now.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, then you are in the catbird seat. What I would do if I were you is go to a site like cardratings.com or creditcards.com and look at the low rate balance transfer offers. Something else you might want to check out is your local credit union a lot of times has a personal loan. It's a 3-year fixed rate loan. The rates tend to be fairly good. You could lock in the rate and pay the debt off over 3 years. So that's something else to check out now that you know that you have a really good score.
So basically what we're saying is they may not be coming to you right now, but you certainly have the ability to go to them.
Great. That's exactly what I'm going to do. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the call and good luck with the move.
Thank you very much. We'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, let's go next to Josh, and he is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Tess.
What do you do there in old Milwaukee?
I am an energy advisor, so I help businesses save energy.
That's a hot topic these days.
Absolutely.
And are people taking advantage? Are there still tax breaks out there for this kind of energy efficiency?
Absolutely. There's all kinds of tax programs, and even more available than that is utility programs, and that's actually what I work with. And based on whatever state or whoever your utility is, there's different options available to you, so you can actually get cash back rather than wait for that tax break.
Ooh, even better.
We absolutely. Like
that. So the key question here is, are you efficient with your money?
I'm working on it, and that's really kind of gets to the heart of my question. I've listened to your program for a number of years now, and you guys are always saying, pay down your debts with the highest interest rate first.
Some people on the show do.
Yeah. Yes. So another person I listen to occasionally is Dave Ramsey.
Yep. We've had him on the show.
I know. I've heard it was a great program. But he advocates for paying down your lowest amount of debt first and then kind of using that to snowball towards your higher debts.
Exactly. In fact, he calls it the snowball method. And
Okay. And
what it does is essentially it gets you to the point where you're paying off credit cards quicker. And then that supposedly mentally gets you excited to keep paying down and paying down and paying down.
Right. So my question is, I don't have any credit card debt to speak of, with the exception of one relatively large purchase I just made.
And what was that for?
It was actually an engagement ring.
Oh! Congratulations.
And thank you.
Josh, can I ask you a very personal question?
Sure.
How much did you spend on the ring?
Approximately $8,500.
And was this connected at all to Valentine's Day?
No, it was not.
Okay.
I'm still working out a plan for how to move forward with that. But currently I am paying down that debt. But it's on a 0% credit card for 18 months.
So you've got the kind of card that Nate actually is looking for now.
Exactly. So it's a great deal. But
good.
I also have student loans, which are a higher interest rate. So my thought is, should I really be paying extra every month to pay down this loan compared to my student loans? Mm-hmm. Or should I put that extra money every month towards those higher interest rates?
Okay.
Interesting question, Liz. I don't know that Dave Ramsey's snowball method, that he talks about that with student loans in the picture. That's really all about credit cards, isn't it?
Yeah. And what he's talking about is sort of a psychological hit of paying off the small balances and working up. And you wind up paying more interest that way. There's no way to get around the math that that's just better.
Right.
Let me ask a couple questions about your student loans, Josh. Are these federal student loans, private student loans? What are the balances we're talking about? And what are the interest rates?
It's a combination. I have federal student loans for my graduate work, mm-hmm. Which is an approximate amount of $20,000,
okay.
Approximately 6%. And then undergrad is also about $20,000 at 3%.
Ah. This is a great question because people come up against this all the time, mm-hmm. and you never know what's going to happen in the future with credit card rates. So this is a variable rate debt. Even though it's 0%, it's still toxic because it's variable. It can go higher. And you don't want to be borrowing money for things like jewelry. So my advice would be get rid of that credit card debt. Don't sweat the student loans until that's gone. And then if you want to prepay some of your federal loans, do start with the higher rate ones. But make sure that you're also saving enough for retirement, that you have an emergency fund. Because when you have federal student loans, this is not the kind of debt that's going to eat you alive. It's the variable rate stuff that's really dangerous.
Great. Thanks, Tess. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, let's go next to Alex in Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Alex.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine today.
Excellent. What do you do there in Wichita?
I'm a podiatrist.
Oh, so you spend your time around stinky feet.
Well, not always, but sometimes. Keeping my fingers crossed.
How did you choose that specialty?
Kind of my longer story. I didn't go to medical school until I was in my mid-30s.
Really? What were you doing up to that point?
I was a merchant seaman in the Gulf of Mexico.
My goodness.
Wow. Yeah.
What prompted that change for you?
Oh, being alone all the time as a merchant seaman.
Yeah. And so any words of wisdom for people who perhaps are in their 20s, early 30s and thinking that it's too late?
Oh, it's never too late.
There you go.
I was living in Florida and I went fishing with a guy that didn't get out of medical school until he was 55.
Wow.
I love that.
I don't think it's ever too late to
follow your passion.
Yeah.
Well, so how can we help you out today?
My question was, I have a windfall of $150,000.
Okay.
I'm newly married and I'm a first-time dad. I have a one-year-old daughter.
Congratulations.
So
yes.
We're looking for a new house. I'm with USAA, and I got a free one-hour consult with a financial advisor, mm-hmm. and he gave me this questionnaire to determine what level of risk I would be comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
And, That was pretty interesting in itself. You had a show on a while ago about, you know, going to the dentist. It's like, I'm going to pull your teeth. How much Novocaine
right.
can we give you?
Yeah, that was Frank Murtha
at
Market Psych. And I don't know, Stephen, do we have a clip of that?
Imagine if you went to a dentist and the dentist said, we want to use the least amount of Novocaine possible. All right. So you tell me what you think the most pain you can take is, and we'll go from there.
So, Liz, basically his point is it's kind of ridiculous to ask what your tolerance of risk is because you're not the professional.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Well, and financial planners kind of know this, and they still have to do those.
Right. What are you thinking about doing with it?
One of my options is to pay cash for this new house that I'm going to buy. And when you mention that to an investment person, they get real quiet on the other end
right.
of the phone. And
yes, they
so
do.
Very uneducated when it comes to bonds and stocks. And if it was me, I'm not sure what I would do. It's not me. It's me and my family.
Well, Liz, a couple of things just off the top of my head. First of all, a house is still a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, most of us don't know a lot about investing. But the way I've had it put to me is that if you are not on Wall Street at all, if you are not in the stock market at all, you're basically saying that you have no faith in American business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it comes down to. I mean, I understand people's skepticism about Wall
Absolutely.
Street.
Absolutely.
Everybody's ticked off about those bonuses. Let me just go through the wrap on the stock market thing.
Okay.
The history of stock market returns. In every one of the 30-year periods since 1928, stocks have eventually come out with an 8% annual return.
Okay.
Now, the other part of this is the issue of, you know, not having a mortgage versus investing. And to me, most people have many, many better things to do than pay off that low-rate tax-deductible debt. Make sure you're on track for retirement. You're saving enough there.
Okay.
You have a one-year-old, so you need to worry about college funding.
Right.
And an emergency fund. So that's a lot of things to cover.
Yeah, and I have my emergency fund, too.
Okay. So if you've got all those ducks in a row, then I would say if you don't want to have a mortgage or want to have less of a mortgage, or if you have a mortgage, you want to pay it down, that's fine. Most people aren't in that lucky position. But if you get all those things covered and still have your windfall to buy a house, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't pay cash.
So does that help you out?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate your time because I wasn't quite sure where I was going to go with that.
All right. Okay. Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us and good question.
Hey, you guys have a great day.
All right, if you've got a question, let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Weston, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. From your questions to your comments, here to help is our senior producer and mail lady, Deb Clark. Hey, Deb.
Hi, Tess. Now, before we start, I need to get one thing from you.
Okay.
Let me have your zip code. I need to...
No way. No how.
But...
No, I have the legal right to say that now. No.
That's right. Last week, we covered the news that California Supreme Court says cashiers are not allowed to ask for your zip code when you buy something.
Right.
Anyway, quite a few people wrote in about this. Some to say, arg, it's annoying that stores do this.
Was that pirates?
No, regular people. But the real reason I mention this is because a couple of people wrote in and said they want to give that information.
What?
Yes, like listener Michael Wilcox. He said that a lot of stores ask this info so they can figure out where to build their next store.
Hmm.
I'll happily tell them, he said, in the hopes they'll come my way. A zip code is a vote.
Vote early, vote often.
Yeah. Now, on to our story also from last week about reverse mortgages, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Okay, let's start with the good, please.
Okay, Heather Vaughan of Haddonfield, New Jersey wrote in. She's been trying to get one of these for her dad, and they had, in fact, just met with a HUD counselor, one of the requirements for the program.
For my dad, the HECM is really a last resort. He lives frugally on Social Security alone, and cash flow is low. He was advised by his counselor and by his daughters to use as little of his lump sum as possible when totally necessary and leave the balance alone.
I think that's probably wise advice. So what about the bad, the ugly?
Well, Scott Hoover in Raleigh, North Carolina, was one bad story. He said that his parents have had a reverse mortgage for about 10 years. Now they have to sell their house. They're taking a huge loss, about $100,000 or so.
Yikes.
And they have to make up the difference because of the terms of the reverse mortgage.
All right. So cautionary tale there.
So on to happier things. Folks also wrote in about our secret shopping segment.
Ah, yes, where you hide purchases from your spouse or your partner. We actually got people to talk to us about this.
Yeah, and I noticed a big box in your office this morning from Zappos.
That was for Devin. That was not for me.
Okay. My favorite story came from Sarah de Opsma in Bozeman, Montana. Check this out.
I was on a trip, and he emailed me a photo of a nice-looking black and white pinto that he said had wandered into our corral.
Okay, I'm assuming that's not a car pinto?
Yeah, actually, she's talking about the secret purchase of a horse.
A horse. Now, how do you keep 1,000 pounds of racehorse beauty secret?
Well, apparently in Big Sky Country, horses do wander in and out of each other's corrals from time to time, but eventually she figured it out.
He knew once I met the horse, I would accept him. He's been part of our family for over 3 years, and I still don't know how much my husband paid for him.
Okay, that one takes the cake. That's my favorite.
Pretty good, huh? Finally, last week, we had a story about the trials and sometimes triumphs of dating while you're out of work. Some folks accused us of buying into a superficial mindset of no money equals no value equals no love life.
Come on, folks. We just report. You decide.
Yeah. Well, Don Lamb of Torrance, California, said he was unemployed for a bit after grad school. He said women's body language would literally change when he told them he wasn't working.
I don't think they want to spend the effort to kind of get to know someone who doesn't have a job. That's unfortunate, but that's just reality.
He just hasn't met the right gal. All right, Deb, here's another reality. We are out of time.
Check. Thanks, Tess.
Please do let us know your thoughts. Post on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. I'm at Radio Tess. Next time, members of the armed forces have plenty of concerns already. Identity theft shouldn't be one of them.
When I swiped my card, it said that I didn't have enough money on it. So then I went to the phone center and looked up at my statements. During the 3 days that I'm outside the wire in Iraq, my credit card was being charged.
Oh, terrible. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vicklund. We will see you next week. This is APM, American Public Media.